Now, while the world has rallied and boycotted, sat in and walked out, yelled and interrupted, expressed every form of protest to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza, it still seems we're not any closer to ending the misery of the Palestinian civilian population there. Sources close to the latest round of indirect ceasefire talks between Hamas and the Zionist entity in Qatar that started last Sunday aren't too upbeat about the way things are going. They say the Israeli delegation presented a withdrawal map that in reality outlines redeployment and repositioning of occupation forces. They said that Hamas has rejected the plan as it essentially legitimizes the reoccupation of approximately half of all of Gaza, turning it into isolated zones. And the state of affairs in Gaza and stalled efforts to change things there are the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for your guests. Joining us, Mr. Mazen Qumsiyeh, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. And also Saad Nimr, professor of political science, joining us at Abruzzo University in occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Mr. Qumsiyeh, we'll start with you out there in Bethlehem. Perhaps the time around Zionist leadership thought that after, more unprecedented barbarity, that Palestinians will accept anything, they thought, in Qatar from last Sunday up until today. And apparently that has not been the case. Your thoughts on why we're still, though, nowhere near securing a ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, clearly the Israeli government, and not just Netanyahu, as a full government, has never been interested in ending this war. They have a war that they think they can win. They think they can ethnically cleanse Gaza in stages, whether it's summarily moving them out of Gaza at the first instance or moving them to Rafah and creating concentration camp or a combination of genocide / ethnic cleansing. And with the full support of the United States, I think they can succeed in this. So they are proceeding as such. They are not interested in any kind of quote-unquote ceasefire, because a ceasefire implies, as the Palestinians and the international world, the global community wants, is a ceasefire leading to end of the hostilities, leading to the end of the occupation of the Gaza Strip. And as you described, Israel wants to occupy 40% of the Gaza Strip, break it into pieces, and piecemeal continue the genocide and the ethnic cleansing, perhaps with a 60-day quote-unquote ceasefire, if it's acceptable to the resistance that they have a ceasefire that's temporary and that leads to renewal of hostilities, as happened before, and renewal of the genocide. So this is not acceptable to the Palestinian people.
Good initial points there. Professor Nimr, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program, sir. And your initial take, please, on why the U.S. and Israeli leadership at this point feel no sense of urgency at all to end the bloodshed and secure a ceasefire. The Israeli prime minister says it's Hamas's fault. They've been holding out all week. not accepting the, well, why would they accept it if it keeps your occupation forces inside of Gaza, in the middle of Gaza, in fact, in essence, partitioning Gaza? Who would accept that? And I mean, that would add more of a risk and instability factor to the future for Palestinians there than it would give them Gaza back.
Good evening, Daniel, and also to your guest from Bethlehem and to all your viewers. Well, it's quite obvious that the Israelis are stalling all these kind of negotiations. They are not interested now in ending the war. It's not only the government and the right wing in the government, but also Netanyahu himself, because he couldn't achieve what he wanted from this war, or from this war against Gaza, this genocidal war. The idea from Netanyahu's point of view and vice versa, the Americans, is that they want a kind of victory. He wants to declare a victory somehow, and victory can't be attained. He failed so far in Gaza after more than 20 months in releasing any of the prisoners or to end the rule of Hamas or the strength of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. So consequently, he wants to get that by the negotiations. And that's why he's putting all these kind of new conditions to the negotiations in order to pressurize the Palestinian resistance in the negotiations through the also the Qataris and the Egyptian and the Americans, especially with Witkoff. So what's going on now, and why the Americans and the Israelis, in spite of what they are talking about, you know, stopping the war, they want to stop the war. But from their point of view, this ceasefire for 60 days, and that will give Israel the right, or Netanyahu, to resume the war immediately after the 60 days. He could get a half of the prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance, but at the same time, he won't give in return what the Palestinian resistance wants. In this case, it's three cases, three issues. First of all, the total withdrawal from of the Israeli army from Gaza, a ceasefire, not a ceasefire, end the war in Gaza, and to have guarantees that Israel is not going back to war after 60 days. And the third thing is about the humanitarian aid, which is supposed to be free from the Israeli hands, if you like, and the American companies, and to be returned back to the international organizations. These are the three issues that the Palestinian resistance insists on, while in Israel they are still talking about these three issues as an impossible to achieve.
And Mr. Qumsi, let's ask why Hamas wants the distribution of aid taken out of the hands of the U.S. and the Israelis. UNICEF, the World WHO, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, the WFP, UNRWA. These are UN agencies with the infrastructure and the expertise to facilitate aid distribution in Gaza, more than any of them, UNRWA. Now, you're taking it out of the hands of these experts. You put it into the hands of U.S. contractors, as Tel Aviv and Washington have. Contractors, many people refer to as mercenaries. As a result, over 800 starving Palestinian aid seekers have been killed by Israeli forces at these so-called aid distribution centers. We have even UN rights experts calling these aid sites death traps.
Indeed, these are death traps, and this is described not just by the United Nations, but also by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and others who, in the international human rights organizations that looked at this situation. This is unacceptable. It's unacceptable to international aid agencies, unacceptable to the UN, and to all decent human beings who looked at this. They realize this is a scam. This is not an aid. It's a scam to basically lure Palestinians and then kill them while claiming they are allowing aid so that they get off the docket of the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice. That is just a scam, no more and no less. And it's an Israeli-American scam, not just an Israeli scam. In fact, there is American mercenaries who are manning these, and many of them are shooting Palestinians waiting for aid. Or, you know, deciding, Palestinians have to decide, I die either by hunger or I die by bullets. Which one do I want to take my chances with? So I think that's a horrific choice to make, and it is basically what is being offered us as Palestinians. Israel is moving along, as I said, with its plan, and because of the Epstein files and all of this, they know that they have the U.S. administration's subsequent ones, whether it's Clinton or Trump, under their thumb. Because the Mossad can blackmail them and release any of the tapes that Epstein and others have recorded on them. So they feel very comfortable that the U.S. will stand with them on all steps and all processes of ethnic cleansing and continuing genocide.
And thank you, Mr. Comsi. And Professor Nimmer, can you please also weigh in on these so-called death traps, these so-called aid distribution centers? Why take them out of the hands of these UN agencies, these experts that have been doing this for dozens of years? What objectives does this fulfill for the U.S. and the Zionists? And why do we have to witness 800 people starving, hungry people that want to feed their families, get killed, seeking aid in Gaza?
Yes, from the very beginning, they wanted this method of distributing the humanitarian aid is to be in their hands in order to control the people in Gaza. It's quite clear, they said that many times, that we need to have the ID cards of all those who are coming into the areas designed to distribute the aid, and we will consider who's going in or who's going out. It's a mean of control. People are starving, people are in hunger, and yet at the same time, the Israeli are deciding who's going to take this kind of food in order to control. They claim that they don't want this distribution of aid, humanitarian aid, to go in the hands of the Palestinian resistance. But this is not true. It's the whole thing is to control the Palestinians. And now it's, it became quite you know, obvious after they declared their plan of keeping the crossing of Morag and in south of Gaza till Philadelphia, which is include Rafah. This area, they want to keep it, and they don't want to redeploy or to withdraw from this area in order to create what they call it, the humanitarian city. So they will let people in, around 600,000 in the first stage, and they will distribute food on them. They will allow them in by their ID cards, and once they are in, they can't get out. So it is a concentration camp, and after that, we never know. It's part of a plan to ethnically cleanse this area, and to, according to the Israelis, they said there is a third country who's willing to take the Palestinians. So they will push Palestinians out of this area directly to this third country. And in this case, they are disposing of one third of the population in Gaza. And then they will repeat the same thing again in order to bring, and because of that, they need to control the food. They need to control the real life of the Palestinians in terms of the humanitarian aid, in order to control them to do so and to go to this humanitarian city, as they call it. So it's part of the plan for you know, the ethnically cleansing of Palestinians, and because of that, they are making that, you know, very important. Otherwise, if the Palestinians have their aid coming from international organizations, which they have no conditions at all against the Palestinians, and they can, you know, have it free and directly and distributed in all over Gaza Strip, it means there is no control for Israel over the Palestinian, using the weapon of hunger and weapon of starvation against the Palestinians.
And Mr. Kumsi, you notice every single day 80 to 100 Palestinians are being slaughtered in Gaza lately. You saw the coffee shop earlier this week, the clinic strewn with children's bodies after Israel's airstrike there, the gas station. Right now, I mean, and just earlier today, here's another headline. Israeli drone kills at least 12 people in Gaza City's food market attack, including a top surgeon. Why is it every time we witness an opportunity for a ceasefire to somewhat materialize, it's accompanied by a dramatic increase in the level of barbarism by the occupation?
Well, clearly the Israeli regime is very interested in maximizing number of people killed and number of people injured. We have to remember for each 100 Palestinian killed daily, there's at least 300 to 400 Palestinians who are injured, most of them with injuries that are debilitating, like losing limbs. And now Gaza has the highest child amputee rate in the world, number of children amputees in the world. This horrific situation that Israel is engaged in, including using banned weapons and using new weapons that they test. That's the Gaza laboratory. They test weapons on the Gaza population. The idea is extermination. That's all it is. And the world community needs to be ashamed of itself, sitting around watching these governments, like the Western governments, who spout sometimes words about local suffering, when they really understand that what's going on has not been done even in the past 100 years before, including in the Second World War. There was never a genocide at this scale, using starvation and thirst and denial of medicines to people, obliterating all the healthcare facilities so that they cannot even treat the injured people and they have to do amputations without anesthesia. This is the horror of what we are witnessing. And my friends in Gaza who lost relatives, one of them, Sakhir, lost both his parents and his brothers, and they're literally, the rest of them, the survivors, are literally starving and so weak they cannot take the risk to go to the so-called aid distribution death traps. He told me that I would go because I'm willing to die, because death may be more merciful than hunger. This is the reality that's happening as we speak in Gaza. Day in and day out. This is day 645 of this accelerating genocide.
Thank you, Mr. Kumsi. And Professor Nimr, and you notice the only people fighting for the women and children of Gaza are Palestinian resistance. I mean, with the escalation of violence by the occupation throughout the last few days and weeks, we've seen retaliatory operations also increase by the resistance, leading to some serious losses for invading Israeli forces. The fact that Hamas is still in a position to say no to an unjust and unfair ceasefire deal that will not benefit Palestinians and still carry out a strong response to this escalation and this violence, what does that say about the resistance today in Gaza?
I think this is the most important issue, and that is the issue which is going really to force Israel to stop the war for many reasons. First of all, there were some studies about, you know, the conduct of the Palestinian resistance since the resuming of the war against Gaza. And they said in the first month, at least, you know, there was, you know, like every week one operation, sometimes, you know, more than even 10 days to have an operation against the Israeli troops. But now we are talking exactly since June and July, that there is an escalation in the situation. This escalation caused, you know, lots of damage to the Israeli army. That proven that now the numbers is talking about itself, that the Palestinian resistance now is doing three or four sometimes big operations, I mean, in Gaza a week, and sometimes more than that, and sometimes also two or three in a day. And that inflicts lots of casualties among the Israeli army. We are talking about, you know, in June alone, there were 20 soldiers were killed. July, we are talking till today, more than 12 soldiers were killed, and we are at the beginning of July. So with this rate, it's really, really very hard for the Israeli army. The Channel 12, which is known in Israel as a brew government and Bruno Netanyahu and the right wing, they conducted a kind of a survey among Israeli soldiers in the army. And they talk about, you know, lots of problems, and they are tired, fatigued, and that they can't do the job. And also the upper groups of the army, they said that they are assigning, you know, to us some assignments which is really not for our expertise. So it means that they don't have new targets apart from killing the civilian. And the Israeli army is really now facing lots of problems, including the lack of lots of soldiers to be in the army as well. And especially that this report, in spite of the fact that the Israeli army officially, they said we have 10,000 casualties among the Israeli army. The report said in this Channel 12 that there is 20,000 casualties among the Israeli army, that they lost them and now they can't go back to fight. In addition to that, not recruiting the Haredim in the army, that make the army really in a very, very bad situation, and we can see that quite clear.
And I'd like Mr. Kumsi, if you could please weigh in on that question as well. We see so many Israelis even asking for an end to the genocide. They want to see their captives back. They want to see an end to this thing, not because they care so much for Palestinian lives, because they care about becoming more of a pariah and isolated in the international community. So they want Benjamin Netanyahu to wrap this thing up in Gaza. You have Israel's closest allies asking for a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, bring the onslaught to an end in Gaza. But Zionist leadership do not listen, which brings us to the point, we hear it often, that Israel only understands the language of force. How basically significant do you see Hamas's role along with Islamic Jihad and what they're doing today for Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, clearly, if we are looking at Israeli public opinion, there's still 82% of Israelis support the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Mm. And the vast majority of Israelis still support the genocide in Gaza. They may differ on the tactics. So the opposition, for example, to Netanyahu, thinks that the tactic should be a withdrawal from Gaza interim, and then we can always go back into Gaza. This is what they argue. So it's a difference on the tactics, not on the goals, which continues to be to obliterate the Palestinian people and any semblance of resistance within the Palestinian people. However, what has happened since October 2023, really, is that the idea that Israel can proceed as it wants with ethnic cleansing that started in 1948 and continued for some 78 years now, and can continue with this with impunity, has reached an end point, because clearly this idea that we are an invincible army and nobody dares attack us was shattered on October 7, 2023. And then it continues to be shattered, because here we are bombarding Gaza, as I said, leveling Gaza for 645 days, and they still have losses. Israeli soldiers are being killed. This shows the futility of crushing a resistance. You cannot crush a resistance. That doesn't happen historically. I'm a historian also, and I know that historically it never happened in the past that you would completely crush a resistance of an indigenous people who are fighting against a colonial racist power, whether it was in South America, South Africa, or Vietnam or any other country, Algeria. Okay. This doesn't happen. So that's what I think is a lesson being learned. And I hope it trickles to the Israeli public and the Israeli leadership.
Thank you.
That they cannot win against the Palestinians by military might.
Thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Mr. Mazin Kumsie joining us from Occupied Bethlehem, and Professor Saad Nimr, they're joining us from Occupied Ramallah. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
WRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to yet another episode of your program, The Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. Today, we're exploring something we all care about, feeling well, not just in body, but deep inside. So let's talk about spirituality and mental health. I know the name is shabby somehow, but inner peace matters, because when we were like kids, we just care about get out and play with other people, with other kids. But when we get like the teenagehood, we felt that there are other things in life that matters as well. That would be the feeling. We wanted to feel happy, like the way we felt at the time of childhood, I guess. So I think we've been through that mood as well. So let's talk about it. Today I am, by the way, let's not forget that we have two dear guests. I shall introduce them now. So let's say start with dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Will you introduce yourself for our audience of this new episode?
My name is Muhammad, and I'm a student of Hawza Ilmiya, and I'm pursuing my master's degree at the moment.
Awesome. Good for you. Thank you so much. Dear brother Ali Reza, another dear guest of our program.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. And I'm also a teacher and a student of the Hawza Ilmiya, and I'm passing my fourth level, which is regarded to be equal to PhD.
Very good. Good for you. So let's just start this talk with dear brother Muhammad. Dear brother, what does spiritual health mean to you? Is just a sentimental sort of name for a new form of meditation or what?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. So when we're talking about spiritual health, it is important to understand what it is by itself. Most of the psychological definitions of body and psychological health, they try to limit the definition of health to basically the body the nervous system to the extent that it is. That's it. That's the border of health. However, there is a as Muslims and as those who are after reality, when we look in reality, the body is the beginning, is just one part of the existence of mankind. There is a soul which is the essence of mankind. And when we're talking about the spiritual health, we're talking about the health of that soul. It's rather the health of that soul really that affects the state of mankind. Sometimes the soul is unhealthy, that's why the body becomes unhealthy. And vice versa, many a times when a body is also unhealthy, the soul might also be affected, but the essence is the soul. And when we're talking about the health, spiritual health, we're talking about the health of that soul, and not just something that deals or is in relation with nervous system. It's not just nerves, and it's not just the brain and the different electronic and electric pulses that happen within our body. No, that's just very limited. But the feeling of happiness, feeling of comfort, feeling of satisfaction, which is a very important feeling of content, is not related to the body and the nervous system. It's related to the soul. The body and the nervous system merely feels the reactions of those feelings of the soul.
Thank you, dear brother Muhammad. Dear brother Ali Reza, regarding what brother Muhammad said, I just want to ask you a question. Some people, especially youth, youngsters, they ask me that if that's true, that avoiding sin is important and keeping a healthy and spiritual-based lifestyle matters, why we've got some, some people, celebrities, some people, they have this sinful way of living and they seem to be happy. Well, at least they fake it. I don't know how they can fake it until when they can just keep doing that. So they say it's okay. They don't care about it. They do not believe that we have such a thing as a sinful life. They say it's your choice. You can do whatever you want. You might face consequences in future, but that's your choice. So do you think that those people suffer too from their sinful life or no?
Just let me remember a verse. He says that وَلَوْلَا أَن يَكُونَ النَّاسُ أُمَّةً وَاهِدَةً لَجَعَلْنَا لِمَنْ يَكْفُرُ بِالرَّحْمَنِ لِبُيُوتِهِمْ سُقُفًا مِنْ فِضَّةً وَمَعَارِجَ عَلَيْهَا يَظْهَرُونَ. If all of the people would not think and would not assume that the way of disbelievers is correct and is the right way, I would give all the blessings in the this world to the disbelievers. And as we have in this verse, roofs of silver for the houses and many things, many blessings would be given to them. Being blessed and having a blessing in this world is not something that we can say that a job and act is true or not. Besides that, I want to complete what the brother Muhammad said about this one, that we have to focus on the meaning of sin. The meaning of sin, as we have, for example, if our body, we know that something, if we, for example, eat something, our body would, we will get illness. So we have to follow some kind of instructions, regulations in order to be healthy. That is the case about our spiritual. If we follow, the instruction given by God, we will get to that what goal. And if we can, if we do not follow that, we wouldn't achieve it.
Thank you so much, dear brother Muhammad. If you, if your soul could talk, what would probably or possibly it would ask you to do more? Would it be like, for example, to listen to that kind of music more? Would it be like to, I don't know, pray more, to give the host of the
soul?
What was it?
I am my soul. What would the soul ask me?
Okay, I don't know. The things that a soul can desire, like to give the host of the show this episode like $1 million or something. Anything you can just think of.
You see, the decisions made by mankind, of course, it goes back to the soul. Whatever is done outside goes back to the soul. That's why in many cases, the word that some people just do cover up their bad things. They say, oh, look at the heart within. The heart within should be clean. Don't worry about what is outside. No, everything comes from inside, as a matter of fact. Everything, all the decisions are made from the soul. If you corrupt the soul, then the decisions outside are like that. Many of the sisters who do not have a proper hijab, when you give them some you know, advice, they come back and say, oh no, your heart should be clean. Don't worry about the appearance. How does the appearance, why do you have to choose this appearance as opposed to a better appearance? Why? Because your heart is corrupt. Whatever is shown in the appearance outside is rather because of the, you know, corruption or the optimism of the heart within, the soul within. So when you fix the soul, when the soul is corrected, that's when the outside, the appearance are corrected. But that's not the other way around, of course. So when you see a hijabi sister, when you see a person who looks pious, it does not necessarily mean the heart and the soul is clean.
No,
sometimes it's just the appearance. But whenever the heart and soul is clean, definitely it affects the appearance. Definitely the appearance is clean. Definitely. There is no even question
on the
that.
You know, apparent behavior.
Exactly,
the way.
Exactly. So we cannot judge from the appearance, but when the soul is clean, then definitely the appearance is clean. That is something. So what my soul says, it depends on my action. Look at my action. Tell me if my soul is clean or not.
Yeah, I'll tell you after the session. Thank you so much. Dear brother Muhammad, dear brother Ali Reza, so how do spiritual people, those people who take spiritual matters seriously, deal with stress? Do you think those people who are more spiritual can handle stress? Because we live in a time that it's like stressful most of the time in this new era. So do you think, leading a spiritual life is sort of a solution to manage or control the amount of stress you're going to expose yourself to?
Yeah, you see, we have another verse in the Holy Quran which says, ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب. That is the remembrance of God. You will feel comfort. So that is the criterion. If the person is has the remembrance of God, he rely on God Almighty, the most powerful,
the
essence of the universe. So if the one is relying on that being, so he will not feel worried about things that happening around him.
So he would feel like he's surrounded by the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the blessing of his presence all over him. Yeah, for sure. So dear Brother Muhammad, just one last question pops into my mind. In your opinion, how do atheists like feel relief because they do not have such a powerful like creator who is thinking, who is like watching?
They do have a creator. They don't believe in that creator.
What do you mean?
They do have a creator, but they do not believe in that creator.
They call it nature, but the nature doesn't care about them. In their view, nature is like wild jungler who is going to attack them or serve them one way or another.
You see, naturally there are remedies, as Brother Ali Reza mentioned, with regards to your question about stand-up comedy and laughing. These are temporary remedies that basically apparently give you that comfort, very short term comfort.
Yeah.
The same way when a person is intoxicated and sleeps, you look at that person, you find the person is in comfort. A person when he is high on weed, you find that person enjoying his activities. Physically, when you look at it, apparently that's the case, but the essence, the truth within is not very clear and is not apparent. The truth within is that person is suffering from within.
Yeah.
That does not have hayatun tayyiba. In tafsir, in the interpretation of this verse, hayatun tayyiba, Imam Sadiq, when at the last few moments of his lifetime, when he was poisoned, the skin was, the bones were very apparent. That was his state. That how bad it was.
Mm.
One of the companions around him, he was very sorrowful about this. He was very, weeping on this. The Imam says, "My dear companion, if if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave us a mountain of gold, just right now, a mountain of gold and wealth, we would say Alhamdulillah and be thankful to Allah. Mm-hmm. And if He takes it away in that same moment, we will still say Alhamdulillah and thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is hayatun tayyibah, that is content. Now for that atheist, will it be the same? That's not necessarily the case.
That's
because when we look at the ghaya, the hadaf, the goal, the end goal of mankind, it's going back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. And when you're tatma'innul qulub, when you're comforted with that, that's the ultimate comfort. You're content with this life.
Thank you so much. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening. I wish you all find your spiritual life full with joy and tranquility. Till another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. What we, the mothers in Gaza, have had to live through in this past year and a half, may no mother ever have to live through that again, says Asmin Khalil Naeem Hassan, mother of four in Gaza. Having lost her husband, widowed mother further says they have become shadows, bodies with no souls, as they await to see who the next missile will take. Here is her story.
Mothers are one of the foundational pillars of Palestinian life, history, and future. They bear their burden with grace and steadfastness. Their humility and humanity knows no bounds. This Israeli genocide has sought to erase everything they represent, but these brave women will never allow this to come to pass. Sadly, life in Gaza has meant constant periods of Tel Aviv-initiated violence against the people already living in the world's largest open-air prison. This war is proving to be the most deadly, but it wasn't the first experienced by Yasmin. As a mother of four, Yasmin reflects on her own educational journey, pledging to do everything for her own children when this genocide finally ends. Looking ahead to a future when death and destruction are now Gaza's permanent shadows can be difficult. It's been tough to come to terms with the scale of this fresh onslaught on the Palestinians. For a people used to impose violence, this was a new and ugly reality. Yasmin has suffered her share of losses, including that of her beloved husband during this genocide. Sadly, her story is the story of so many of Gaza's new class, the war widows. Washington has made no secrets of the nefarious plans they have for Gaza and its people. Palestinians know what it's like watching interlopers attempt to displace them for land. Despite the difficulties Yasmin and her four young children are experiencing, the promise of a better future, personified by faith, is at the heart of their coping strategy. Gazan mothers are brave, but they're tired. Tired of empty rhetoric, of false brotherly bonds, of political posturing. The war needs to stop. Palestinians need to be free. Yasmin wants what we all do, a better future for our loved ones, one dominated by a new peace, a lasting peace.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Yasmin's journey is Father Frank Galli, an Anglican priest. Welcome, Father.
Thanks for inviting me.
Father, let me start by asking you, did you really think we'd still be here a year and a half, that this would still be going on? And how can human beings stoop to the levels that the Israelis have?
The answer is yes and no. No, because, yes, as you say, I mean, what we just watched is heartbreaking. It is the horror of what we have witnessed, what we're still witnessing every day, is unbelievably beggars of imagination that anyone can stoop so low to starve, murder, wound, and completely wipe out, or try to wipe out, a whole population, over 2 million people, women, children, the lady in question, and the children. I mean, you know, this is not sentimentality. Anybody, any person with a modicum of decency would absolutely be aghast at the suffering of children, innocent people by definition. So, I mean, the people of Gaza and Palestine in general have suffered what in Christianity we call it a Calvary, which is a path of suffering, alluding to Jesus' suffering on the way to the cross. And incidentally, I believe that Palestine, Gaza Palestine today, could be described as the Christ among the nations. Mm-hmm. Gaza is the Christ among the nations. We used to say some nations, Poland under the Tsarist Russian oppression, was the Christ of the nation. Well, today it is Palestine.
Does this mean that you are expecting Palestine to be the salvation for the world then?
Well, that is a very good question. I would like to say that it could be the beginning of an awakening. It could be, depends on God. But I want to come back to your question. So I did not expect this to be horrible, but in a way I did. Yes, because I'm aware of a Zionist project, which has been to completely to wipe out, to either transfer or remove a Palestinian population onto a nearby country or the desert or whatever, or eliminate, destroy it. This is not new. Menachem Begin, who was prime minister of Israel many years ago, who tricked President Carter, the United States president, into a Camp David agreement, Menachem Begin made it quite clear that he wanted the Palestinians to be expelled, to be driven out. And incidentally, Menachem Begin was a former terrorist, which reminds us Israel was born out of terrorism.
Absolutely.
Israel is a terrorist state in its inception. It has a bloody goal, the effrontery of calling resistors terrorists. I mean, it tells its own story. So I was aware of this project to completely eliminate the Palestinians, and West Bank included, yeah. Which Begin called, they still call it an Netanyahu Brigade. They used Judea and Samaria, the biblical names for those lands, which of course begs the question, because the Jews today have very little to do with the ancient Hebrews, but yeah. Leaving that aside.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Christianity, since you bring in the Bible. You know, there's a lot of talks about Muslim countries not doing enough. And we've heard of, you know, Yasmin saying that they're only sending them shrouds and, you know, earpieces to block the bombs. But also, Father, you know, Gazans have also got Christians. What is the Christian world doing about that?
So the Christian presence in Gaza is very small. I think it's less than 1%. But it's symbolically important. There is a church in Gaza which was bombed, an Orthodox church, St. Porphyria, I believe, was bombed by Israel. They didn't give a damn. And so, yeah, Christians.
It's also the birthplace of Jesus, so whatever the population is rather important, isn't it?
Bethlehem, yeah. Yes. There is actually a pastor, Munzer Isaacs, yeah. Who was in London recently, who is from Bethlehem. He's a Lutheran, and he gave a very powerful, I went to a church where he spoke, a very powerful witness of what it is like for Palestinians to be in the Holy Land today. It's a complete, a new martyrdom once again. If you ask me, what are the Christians doing today? Well, there is the Quakers. a small but important part of Christianity in this country. There has been an annual gatherings where they came out very recently saying that they decided to say quite openly that what is happening in Gaza is genocide. Mm-hmm. So they have accused Israelis of committing genocide. That is, it's a beginning. Now, whether it will spread out to the mainline churches, I doubt it, because at the end of the day, well, it's partly the stranglehold which the Zionists had placed on the minds and hearts of many Christians. Oh, well, the Jews suffered at the hand of the Germans, therefore anti-Semites, so we can't. But a great crime does not justify another crime.
Absolutely.
You cannot justify a genocide by appealing to a former genocide.
Definitely.
It's a Holocaust.
Yeah. Let's stay with the role of Christianity, Father Galli. I know you are Anglican, but I want to talk about the Catholic Church, you know, about the Pope. We had a Pope who was very pro-Palestinian, and now we have a new Pope who's talking about ceasefire. I've just heard him speak about, you know, but how much power does the Vatican has? Because they are saying these things, but nobody's listening to them.
Well, Stalin once, when someone mentioned the Vatican to him during that was after the Second World War, said, "How many divisions has the Pope?" So he was putting quite brutally, unless the Pope had several armed forces divisions, it didn't matter a fig to him. But of course, when Stalin died, Pope Pius XII said, now Stalin will see how many divisions we have in heaven, how many angelic divisions we have. So that was interesting. But coming back to your question, how many influence has the Vatican today? Well, it has an indirect influence. It has spiritual influence. In political, practical terms, the political influence is relative. And also, let us remember, the Zionists, whenever the church has tried to do something significant from the ethical point of view, they've trotted up some various charges, accusations. They come up for skeletons out of a cupboard. I remember when the American bishops wanted to condemn nuclear weapons, they immediately came out with a spate of thinking about sexual abuse. Maybe true, but I mean, it's interesting, we were concocted by lawyers of a certain persuasion at the time. So I think the Vatican is also a little bit afraid of coming out too strongly in favor of Palestine.
It's the same controlling imperialist, Zionist leadership around the world that basically controls everyone. Let's very quickly, we have very little time, talk about the UK's role. I mean, recently, you know, David Lammy talking all these big talks about, you know, changing the tone and taking Israel to account. At the same